Magnesium plays a critical role in vital bodily functions, including energy production, heart health, immunity, and more restful sleep. Magnesium is ubiquitous in metabolic pathways that affect virtually all organ systems. So I'm excited to tell you about MagSRT from Jigsaw Health. MagSRT has rightfully earned a reputation as the most popular, most bioavailable, and best-tolerated magnesium brands in the world. The developers of MagSRT have solved a problem that deters many from getting adequate intake of elemental magnesium. Their unique formulation is gentle on the stomach and doesn't produce unwanted GI effects. Jigsaw Health also offers MagSoothe, a great-tasting, fast-acting, calming magnesium glycinate powder that helps relax your legs, muscles, and brain for better sleep. Jigsaw MagSoothe helps you fall asleep faster, sleep better, and reduces leg cramps. For more information and to order MagSRT and MagSoothe, just go to jigsawhealth.com. That's jigsawhealth.com. Use coupon code HOFFMAN10 for $10 off your order. That's jigsawhealth.com and use code HOFFMAN10 for MagSRT and MagSoothe. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. My favorite time of the week because, well, it's time for Q&A with Layla. And that means I get to engage in a great conversation with our resident nutritionist together. We share our expertise with you in regard to questions that you can send to questions@drhoffman.net. We thank you because we got a full mailbox of questions, and many of them are very thought-provoking, and hopefully we'll have an interesting time of it. How you doing, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman, how are you?
Very well, thanks. And finally, the nice weather is arriving here in New York. And I took a walk in Central Park the other day. Actually, I was right next to Central Park, and things are really happening at a rapid rate. Almost from day to day, you know, the greening of the trees and the blossoms busting out all over. And
I have bees on my patio.
Yeah,
Bees on my patio.
Yep.
Where I've got some foliage and stuff like that. It's nice to sit there with all that, with the sun. Yeah.
On the other hand, a lot of people are sneezing and wheezing and coughing because the pollen counts are high.
Yes.
And so, yeah, kind of a, you know, it's a mixed bag for some allergy sufferers. We got lots to talk about today. We're going to take your questions. Questions come to questions@drhoffman.net. And before we do that, you know, here's a little bit of a follow-up. You know, we talked about Ozempic, and we talked about how the jingle for Ozempic, and it's really kind of an earworm. You know, it just... Once you hear it, it just keeps on.
It's a great hook.
Yeah,
it is. Great songwriting. It's a terrific hook. Yeah.
And so there's a great article in the New York Times, you may have seen it, called How Ozempic Turned a 1970s Hit into an Inescapable Jingle. And I'll give you a little taste of it here. Little time travel there, right?
Oh, my goodness.
All right, so there you have it. So that they
yes.
So you know what? You know, I once said this. I called it back when I was like in my teens and twenties. You know, you'd walk around in a supermarket and remember the days when they just played like innocuous muzak, kind of like elevator music.
Yeah.
And I said, and I called it. I called it right. I said, in 50 years, they'll be playing rock and roll in supermarkets, and you're going to have, you know, like the Rolling Stones and all these like contemporary hits, and they're going to be the classics. And wouldn't you know, that's part of the supermarket experience these days, is you get to hear like classic rock in supermarkets. And so, you know,
it's the new Muzak, but it's not Muzak. Yeah.
Right. So the story is, you know, a little bit about this guy. It sounds like his band Pilot was kind of a one-hit wonder, right?
Kind of. You didn't really hear about them that much after, what, you know, the 1970s or so. But that song, Magic by Pilot, is pretty catchy. And my understanding is the singer of that song, Magic, is also singing on the Ozempic jingle.
Exactly, because it sounds, it's
many
perfectly cloned.
Many decades later, yeah.
Yeah. And it's kind of hard because he had to hit some high notes. You know, there's a lot of, octaves or registers that you have to hit in order to, you know, sing, like that whole thing, that progression. David Paton, they say in February 2023, he walked into London's Abbey Road Studios, and 50 years after recording the original song, Magic, he recorded the Ozempic jingle. And so they say, but they didn't disclose, they say it was a seven-figure deal. So, you know, like a million plus that he got, you know, maybe multiples of $1 million. So he kind of really hit it. And, you know, the thought behind it is that the people using Ozempic tend to skew a little older, right? Although they can be young. So you want to have
a classic
song. They
can be young, you know? It's,
So you want to have a classic song, but also they say that it's an ideal song. They tried out a lot of songs because there's a lot of songs like, oh, this, oh, that, you know, oh, blah, dee, oh, blah, da, you know. But this one really resonated. And also it has the connotation of magic. You know, the pounds effortlessly melt away like magic. So it's really, and it's really worked for them. You know, the drug Mounjaro actually is more effective according to clinical trials. And it's actually semaglutide teamed with another blocker or agonist, actually, not in this case, not a blocker, but something that works on the intestinal hormonal system and pancreas. And it it's actually more effective, but I think the sales of Mounjaro lag far behind Ozempic. And part of it is, can you think of, is there a Mounjaro theme song?
I can't think of one. No, no. Right. And you know what? Somebody needs to do something about that.
Exactly. Okay. Well, hey, millions of dollars are out there for the taking if you come up with the right jingle for Mounjaro.
Right.
So think about it.
And Dr. Hoffman, I just tell me how it's pronounced. Is it semaglutide or semaglutide?
Well,
because I've come full circle on
I've heard.
I was first calling it semaglutide. Then I was corrected to call it semaglutide.
Right.
And we're back to semaglutide.
Yeah. And that's what I'm hearing lately. I actually had somebody, you know, question me and say, well, you know, these semaglutides, can you give me something stronger, like a, just a glutide? And I go, no, that's not how it works. It's not a semi-glutide. It's spelled S-A-M-A. You know, so it's just the name.
Sema.
It's not a, semi-glutide, you know, whatever.
Right.
And I have no idea what the you know, there's actually a theory that the medical names, the generic names, are deliberately really crappy names because when things go off patent and then you have generic, you know, drugs, that they want the names to be really crappy so that people will buy the, will keep buying the brand name drugs that have really cool names like Ozempic, Mounjaro, you know, and so,
Zepbound.
Well, Zepbound, that's the other version of Mounjaro. Mounjaro is supposed to be for diabetes, and Zepbound is actually specifically targeted to weight gain. I can't think of a
and
Wegovy. Song.
And Wegovy?
Wegovy, yeah, it's kind of a cool name, but yeah, Wegovy's another one. So, anyway.
Wegovy's good. That could catch a jingle. Somebody will come up or come up with something Wegovy.
But I can't understand
Wegovy, something.
I can't understand why they're trying to sell it because there's like tremendous shortages of these medications.
Yeah,
They can't keep up with the demand. You know, it's just impossible.
Well, they could jack up their prices with such a high demand, right?
Yeah,
supply and demand.
I guess so.
Yeah.
So anyway, all right. So on that front, I wanted to, before we get into our questions, we have quite a few today, but I just wanted to talk about. You know, I've been writing a series of articles entitled "Breakthrough Treatments That We Don't Really Need," and so I've written a couple. A second installment will come out this week, and a third installment will come out next week. I talked about the lifelong cholesterol medication, you know, that knocks out your cholesterol for an entire lifetime. Yeah, I'm not sure.
Oh my God, that's frightening.
Yeah, I'm not sure we really need the time.
Oh, that's frightening.
Okay, here's one. An anti-smoking vaccine. All right.
What?
Yep, a vaccine.
Did I hear you correctly? You said an anti-smoking vaccine.
Yeah, it's the nicotine vaccine.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And actually, they've been working on this for, you know, quite a long time, for, you know, over a decade. And on the principle that, you know, we still have a lot of people irrationally smoking. And through all the methods we have to get people to stop smoking, you know, the behavioral methods and the medications and even nicotine substitution, still a fairly high percentage of people can't quit smoking. Okay. So enter the nicotine vaccine. And how this works, and I'm quoting, the nicotine vaccine is intended to treat drug abuse. Okay. We call, you know, tobacco addiction. This is for
like naltrexone.
Well, no. Naltrexone could do it because it kind of hits the pleasure centers of the brain, but they, so far that hasn't really worked on smoking. Through active immunization by inducing nicotine-specific monoclonal antibodies. You know, MABs. To sequester and reduce nicotine distribution inside the brain. What could possibly go wrong with that? So here's the thing. They've tested it, and according to a Cochrane review, and a Cochrane kind of rates therapies, they're kind of an independent rater. You know, so even if a drug company says, hey, this is really cool, Cochrane will come in and say, hey, you know, they even say the PSA is overrated. They're quite controversial recommendation that maybe the PSA creates more harm than good. Cochrane is a little skeptical about the benefits. They say, they reviewed four studies on this, and they say none of the four studies detected a statistically significant difference in long-term cessation between participants receiving the vaccine and those receiving placebo. And in the studies, there was a paltry quit rate of 11% with either placebo or the unvaccinated. I mean, you give somebody a placebo and they're going to say, well, hey, you know, I got a treatment and, you know, it could work, but only 11% of both treated and untreated people quit. But here's the thing.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. Is it really a good idea to kill the nicotine in your brain? Is that a sound principle? Because there's actually some evidence that the thing that kills you about cigarettes is not the nicotine, it's the tar and the chemicals and the basically the burning plant material that you inhale to get the substance that you're addicted to. And there's not a lot of really long-term studies of people who take nicotine replacement for a lifetime, but there are, you know, there's certainly a scientific basis for believing that nicotine, you know, there's this thing in the brain called NAD, which is nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. It's kind of like, you know, it sounds like nicotine, and there's some of the receptors for brain energy are related to nicotine. And there's no question. I mean, ask a smoker. And did you used to smoke, by the way? Did you ever smoke?
I did. I quit in 1992.
But you know, when you were a smoker. When you needed to focus or concentrate, or when you were anxious or something like that, you'd light up a cigarette, and really, it did something. And that's the nicotine. Yeah. And there are actually studies that show that nicotine enhances brain energetics, that there is a reduced incidence of Parkinson's disease with nicotine.
Wow.
Perhaps there's also an anti-dementia effect. So maybe that's such a good idea to knock out all the nicotine in the brain. I mean, it would be less gratifying to smoke because you wouldn't get that, you know, it would kind of kill the nicotine rush that you get from a cigarette.
Right.
But that it doesn't even work. So
No.
So this is an idea whose time has not come. And meanwhile, the anti-smoking vaccine trials have kind of ground to a halt because they think it's kind of a dead end. So don't worry about it. They won't be putting it on your vaccine schedule. You know, you'll be getting like, you know, 35 vaccines, and they'll say, well, you know, maybe your kids need the smoking vaccine now. It's like, wow.
They'll never start. They won't do anything or something.
You take your 9-year-old to the pediatrician and they say, well, let's give them the anti-smoking vaccine because we know how it is, you know, in middle school that kids start, you know, vaping and
Yes.
Not going to work. Not going to happen.
Oh my goodness. Oh my God.
So that was one of my breakthrough treatments that perhaps we don't really need. And there are a whole lot more that I have assembled in a series of articles in our newsletters. If you haven't yet subscribed, go to our page and subscribe to our newsletter, or that's how you do it. Or, you know, you don't want to subscribe, fine. Won't come into your inbox. You'll have to go to the website every week and read it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I can't wait to read about that, Dr. Hoffman. That's really something. I really thought you were kidding when you said nicotine vaccine.
No.
They're
really, look, this system of medical innovation, highly lucrative, and there are some perverse incentives, you know, for really getting people signed up for expensive, I think, kind of Rube Goldberg treatments, because, you know, I just assume treat, and you see me treat people who have who are smokers. I just say, look, stop smoking cigarettes and knock yourself out. Chew the gum, put the patch on, you know, take the lozenges, because it's harm reduction, and that you may need a lifelong nicotine replacement, and it's, we don't even think that's going to be harmful for you.
And you know what? Do you remember that antidepressant they would give smokers to help them quit? Was it called Chantix?
Yeah, Chantix is Buspar. It's Buspar.
Okay.
I'm sorry. It's
Wellbutrin.
Wellbutrin. It's Wellbutrin. Yeah, Chantix.
It's Wellbutrin.
And it's just they applied another name to it.
I see.
That
to make it more specific
Right.
All right.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, look. I wish I could count on, you know, the number of hands that I have on one hand, the number of people who've, in my experience, stop with that. Very few people stop with Chantix.
True. And I know a couple of people personally who not only didn't quit smoking, but they continue to take Chantix for years.
Okay.
Like, why?
Right.
Why?
Oh, okay.
Maybe you should stop.
So if it doesn't work, anyway. Why keep taking it? Yeah. Okay.
Exactly. Unbelievable. Perverse is the operative word, coming back to the nicotine vaccine. I can't believe my ears sometimes, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, the hits keep rolling in. And I was going to just write, one article, and I said, well, I've got enough material for two articles. And then it turns out I can't contain myself to two articles.
You might have to do a small volume book.
Exactly. Hey, that's great concept.
That's a good idea.
Good.
Yeah.
All right. Let's get to questions, because we promise to answer as many questions as we can. So questions@drhoffman.net. And to demonstrate our authenticity, if you hear a little background noise, yes, we are recording in Manhattan. And the sound of ambulances is ubiquitous here in New York City. So
it's part of the sound of the city.
The soundscape of New York. Okay. Yeah.
Yes. Okay, we've got an email from Freddie. Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. I'm a 70-year-old man. I eat well and I exercise. And I'm curious about protein supplements. I drink a protein mix about an hour before I work out. I walk at a fast pace. I do some weightlifting. Is it better to use a whey protein powder or a plant-based powder as my protein source to build and maintain muscle as I age? And should I drink my mix before or after my workout, or can I drink some before and after exercising?
See, I can't imagine that you'd get a good workout after, you know, with all that stuff gurgling around in your stomach.
Exactly. You can't drink something and then exercise maybe an hour and a half before, but it is known that the best time to take your protein supplement would be within a 60-minute window post-exercise. However, Dr. Hoffman, I recently read an editorial that said as long as it's within 6 hours of your exercise,
meaning that's the new thing.
Your exercise could be within that six-hour period of time, it doesn't matter before or after
That's the new thing. And used to be like...
That's the new thing on this, which is interesting.
Like, within 45 minutes of your exercise, you know, while your muscles are crying out for sustenance, you know,
help repair me.
Pour that protein in.
Right.
It turns out not to be the case. There's also a little bit of mojo on the concept that It's best to take protein supplements at or near bedtime, because nighttime is when growth hormone is most active, and it's more likely that the protein will be incorporated into your muscles. I can't see that as a great idea, because taking a lot of liquid at night is not great for, you know, bathroom.
It's the equivalent of eating a meal, and you want autophagy to happen.
Right. And the other thing is, you know, if it's liquid and you go horizontal, you know, you could have reflux, and, you know, probably not the greatest idea. So I would say, you know, after, and in, I really think that whey protein is superior. Although
it's superior to plant-based.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I do think so. And
whey,
I use
protein, whey protein will be superior to plant-based. Yeah. Yeah.
Because of the
branched chain amino acids, for example, the plant-based protein may have that. But again, you know, a team is only as good as its weakest player.
Yeah.
Plant proteins, unfortunately, fall into that space of, you know, the weaker so-called amino acids, if I may phrase it that way. It's not really completely correct how I'm saying it, but the plant-based proteins don't compare.
Yeah. And as an over,
whey
as an over 70
or an animal protein supplement.
Excuse me. Mm-hmm. As an over 70, I'm full into taking protein drinks. And protein drinks are a nice vehicle for the things that I take. And, you know, I think I'm not going to belabor people with, you know, all the things that I throw in there, because it gets repetitive. But I also take creatine, which I think is helpful for both muscle and brain. And, you know, it kind of blends nicely, because it's a relatively tasteless thing with the protein. Yeah, you can be imagined if you put a lot of different things in there. Just don't put a banana in there, because A, it's just a lot of calories. And also there's this thing called polyphenol oxidase in bananas, especially ripe bananas, which tends to kind of counteract the benefits of the polyphenols. So if you're putting in, I don't know, cocoa polyphenols, or if you're putting in like berries or something into your, you know, or even, you know, what I do is I put in green tea. Matcha.
Very
good. It tastes like matcha ice cream, you know, Japanese restaurant ice cream. And that's a nice flavor, and it's a polyphenol. And I don't particularly like the taste of plain matcha, but when I put it in the shake, it's kind of like that Japanese green tea ice cream. Yeah, but don't put a banana in, because this is kind of the new thing. But yeah, and banana is, to me, just a, you know, if somebody might want to
put a lot of
calories,
sugar.
You know, like if somebody is, we do have patients who we want to have help them gain weight. So we'll say, okay, you know, put banana.
I tell
in
them every day they must eat bananas and nut butters.
Yeah. Yeah.
And bread if they want to gain weight. But listen, a medium banana is about 27 grams of carbs.
Ooh.
Okay. But it is very high in sugar. Remember, it's a tropical fruit.
Mm-hmm.
And having sugar after a workout may actually put a quash on any growth hormone that all that beautiful exercise is helping to secrete.
That's interesting.
So one of the worst things we could do after the gym is go eat something sweet like a fruit yogurt and a banana, because everybody's looking to replace their glycogen. I want to remind everybody, except the elite athletes out there, that phase one of fat storage starts with the restoration of glycogen. So be careful that. You don't want to just go to the gym to burn up your glycogen. You want to be burning fat.
Yeah, yeah. So
you want to be burning fat.
This whole notion of taking like a very sugary drink before you work out, it's a really absurd notion.
No.
Unless, you know, you're doing something like a Tour de France bicycling, okay?
At
that level, you know, when you're going like, you know, 6, 7, 8 hours, you know, like, 200 miles, you know, up the Alps or something. Okay, I get it. You know, you got to really take in sugary stuff. Fine, but with ordinary workout, you kind of abrogate the fat burning aspects of a workout by taking in too much sugar before or after, you know. So
exactly,
not a great idea.
Exactly. I always encourage people, especially the morning exercisers, to always go exercise on an empty stomach.
Yeah, I do.
Some people have breakfast and things like that. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's the best way to do it.
And then you'll get
nice and mildly hungry afterwards.
Right. The only time you don't is if I have a really long bike ride, you know, might have a little bit of oatmeal.
You want to fuel up for that.
Some dates. Or in the winter, if it's like really cold and I'm waiting for it to get, you know, like above 40 or something. You know, so I wait till like maybe, you know, 10:30 or 11. but I've gotten up at 7, so I really need to eat a little something. It's going to, a little too long, and I'm going to be bonking during the bike ride, so I might have something. But then I don't even, like, for most of the exercises, I don't eat during the exercise, you know, unless it's a super long, mm-hmm. like a 50-mile bike ride or something. Okay, I'll take some, like a bar or something. But I try to, I think...
You have to, you hit a wall otherwise, right?
Yeah. But, you know, you can train to it. People who are poorly conditioned hit the wall much earlier than people who train in a fasted state, because your body adapts to it. And you actually probably create more glycogen storage sites, or your metabolism changes in such a way that you might be burning fat. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Freddie, we hope this answers your question. Keep on keeping on.
Yeah, it's a good question, because I think a lot of people are you know, trying to fend off sarcopenia with protein supplements. And
yeah,
I think that this is in the wheelhouse of a lot of people's efforts to stay healthy. Okay. Unfortunately, absolutely. We need to pause because we divide our podcast into two parts. We promise in part two, we're going to focus entirely on your questions. Questions come to questions@drhoffman.net. Give us a preview of what we're going to tackle in the next segment.
I like to drink carbonated water that's sometimes flavored. Is this something to worry about in our drinks?
Okay. Interesting question. And I think that this is a predicament that a lot of people face. And so we'll tackle it in part two. Today, it's our weekly Q&A with Layla. Questions can come to questions@drhoffman.net. We welcome your questions. And we'll also welcome comments. We have comments on some of the things that we've done lately, you know, some of our interviews and podcasts, or, you know, even we welcome corrections, because sometimes we may misspeak, or, you know, things we say may be subject to your interpretation that maybe we don't have it right.
Mm-hmm.
We're happy to address that. So, the questions at drhoffman.net is a place to go for that. Thank you. We'll be right back. Stay with us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Layla Mutin. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla. And this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.